The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Now, clinical psychologist Dr. Tony Bates joins me from our Sligo studio.
Hello,
Tony,
Brendan.
Good afternoon.
Hello, Brendan. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. You know, Tony, we can have these long, tortured conversations that you and I have about how can we be happier and how can we feel better and everything. But you can't beat a sunny day, can you? For most people. I'd say down
great.
There in Sligo today on a sunny day, it feels very far away from the problems of the world.
Well, I woke to clouds, but it was cool and that was welcome. And now the clouds are lifting and the sky is blue and it's going to be a beautiful day and probably a tolerable temperature, more tolerable maybe than Dublin.
Yeah, and it certainly, I think it does the trick for most people to
lift
things. Yeah,
sure.
And listen, as it happens, right, we've been hearing a lot about the effect COVID and the restrictions have had on people's mental health. But you are going to tell us today that it might not be as bad as we first thought. There's new research.
Yeah, there's a really important research that maybe shows that things are not quite what we might have expected. So if we go back to spring of 2020, I mean, article after article in my world warned of a looming psychological epidemic, you know, because all of the key factors that cause psychological breakdown were in place. There was sudden disruption, loss of social connection, loss of livelihoods. Millions of people were bereaved. And the most vulnerable were subjected to long-lasting, relentless strain. So it seemed that a global collapse in well-being was inevitable. So these the Lancet, which is a pretty reputable publication, the Lancet COVID-19 Division Task Force, they commissioned a paper to look at all of the studies that have been done since then and since then, and to see what actually was the long-term impact on our mental health.
Okay.
And so they looked at, you know, over 1,000 papers, they looked at over hundreds of thousands of people represented in those, and in over 100 countries. So it's pretty widespread. And what they found was interesting. Initially, it was exactly what was expected. It was a dramatic climb in all kinds of measures of distress. In the USA and Norway, depression increased threefold. In a study of 50,000 people in the UK last spring, over 40% there was an over 40% rise in the number of people who were feeling distressed generally. But by summer, the average levels of anxiety, depression and distress began to fall. Now, some data sets show distress had fallen to pre-pandemic levels and everything seemed to be settling. And then they wondered, well, maybe people aren't feeling so bad, but surely they're not feeling any great satisfaction with their lives at the moment. And probably that has reduced. So the Gallup poll organization, they collect population data on satisfaction levels every year. Mm. And they did the same last year and they found there was no change. So on a 0 to 10, it turns out that we, on average, feel 5.75 satisfaction on a 0 to 10 scale, 10 being exhilaration. But actually, it returned to exactly that. So then they wondered, well, maybe people are, you know, it's not obvious. Maybe some of the distress, you know, those people aren't completing surveys.
You see, so that's what you think, yeah.
Yeah,
because
that's what you think.
It's been patchy in how this has affected various people, yeah.
Oh, no, they found that later. Now, they'll come to that because that's probably the most important finding. But so they looked at suicide rates in 21 countries where there was kind of reliable government data. And they found that between April and July, there was no increase. And in fact, there was evidence in many countries of a decrease. So overall, they concluded the majority of people who were surveyed most recently reported no decline in their mental health. So it's not, at one level, it's not as bad. Now, data tells a story, but there's always a number of ways to read that story. So how are we to make sense of these? For these authors, the data seem to say that as human beings, we have a psychological immune system, which is capable of adapting and responding to change and to trauma and to distress.
Okay, so that once we kind of adjusted really, that initially everybody went into distress and anxiety and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
But that then we adjusted quite quickly.
By summer of 2020, people were getting creative about lockdown. There were drive-by birthday parties, people singing on balconies, clapping on doorsteps, and many people found ways to reweave their social network. We appreciated people we hadn't we'd taken entirely for granted up to then, and we made an effort to show people we cared. So this capacity in humanity just to kind of rally and to adapt and to be creative is something that these authors feel is at the heart of the story.
And that is what you would call this psychological immune system.
Yeah. But we need to be careful because broad trends and averages can hide real struggles. And one finding that emerged in their paper was that the coronavirus's mental health toll was not distributed equally. Women and parents of young children, people facing financial issues, people who got sick with COVID-19, and those who'd been struggling with physical and mental vulnerabilities prior to the academic, all of these got gradually worse as the pandemic stretched out. So you've got sort of a majority, 50, 60% who are picking up, and you've got another group that are picking, that are falling down, and it would be terribly mistaken to forget that that's also true.
Yeah, yeah, and we wouldn't like to suggest in any way that there is not huge distress
absolutely.
Out there and everything.
Yeah.
So this psychological immune system, you know the way, so with normal immunity, we kind of get inoculated by picking up maybe milder strands of viruses or whatever, by having been sick before. Or we get a job, obviously. But so the psychological immune system, does that get built up in a similar way that like if bad things have happened to you in the past and you've got through them, that builds up, I suppose, to use that overused word, resilience, is it?
Well, I mean, but let's think of it as kind of a story we have for how our lives work. So at any point, I have a story of, you know, who I am, what I can cope with, what should happen, what shouldn't happen. And then life has a way of breaking all my rules. And so, you know, disturbing things happen. You know, that's the nature of things. And the question is, you know, I then have to adapt. I have to kind of change my story. I need a bigger boat. I need to be able to take on board things that are not easy to acknowledge in life.
Give me a for example there, Tony.
Well, I mean, yesterday I was this is a very small example in the scale of things, but yesterday I was motoring along beautifully on a sunny day in Sligo, and then at 2 o'clock I discovered I lost my wallet. And you know, I had been to the bank and got special money out for someone, and I'd also had all my cards and my civil service thing and license and everything. And, you know, I said, no, I couldn't have lost. You go into denial. And then I went through this obsessive searching through the house and the car and under the car and taking out the engine and taking it apart and every possible place that I could be at home. And then there's the realization that, you know, I've lost it. And then there's this horrible paranoid feeling that I've, you know. But so, if you like, my whole sense of life in that moment, it sort of seems to fall apart. Now, I kept searching and went through all the self-blame, the other blame, the life is unfair, the wallowing in self, whatever. And then I found it at 10 o'clock last night. It was in a perfectly logical place, but not somewhere in a million years I would have thought to look. And I accidentally just came across it. But I think, you know, I've had to sit back and say, now, hold on, what's going on here? And I think the question for immunity for me is not that those things don't happen, but how prepared am I to cope with that and to adapt to that and deal with that? And I think, you know, we think of physical immunity, and one of the ways we know that is important is nutrition. You know, and this is nutrition. Physical immunity begins with the care of the body. And I think mental health is the same. It begins with the body. We need nutrition. We need to eat less, mainly plants, drink more water, and exercise and rest. We need both. You know, these are. These
and look,
are,
I don't know if you heard Hilda Hamilton.
I did.
To me yesterday. And I mean, you know, all kinds of terrible mental and emotional issues. But actually, it was, as Richard Carney said here before, back to the body. That was the starting point of the building block for how she looks after herself now. Is the body.
And she brought up another, I want to come to something else because it really sort of, you know, influenced what I want to say today. But, you know, she, so I think that's the first thing. But there's, when we come to psychologically, we need something more, okay?
Yeah.
Because we need something more because life is scary. And we need relationships. We need healthier relationships. We need relationships. And this pandemic, pandemic has reminded us of how much we need them. And I mean healthy relationships, good friendships, which give us back a sense of our dignity. You know, and it seemed to me, listening to Hilda, was it, that, you know, when things go wrong, human beings lose touch with their dignity. When they're in touch with their dignity, they can face almost any challenge. We trust ourselves, we believe in ourselves, but that goes out the window. So when we turn to relationships, whether they're with friends or they're with a doctor, what we need most is to be reminded of our dignity. What her experience sadly was one where she was anything but reminded of her dignity. She was told that there was no rhyme nor reason why she was feeling the way she was feeling. And that's, I think, you know,
Can I just take, so on the broader issue of that then, so and Hilda mentioned that thing about the five people you hang out with most, that's who you are. So you're saying we cultivate relationships and friendships that remind us of our dignity. Can you, it sounds interesting, can you make it more concrete for me?
Well, I think, okay, I think we have healthy relationships and they help us to know who we are. OK, and they help us to feel secure in the world that can be very scary and upsetting at times. They help us to feel like we're worth something, like we matter. We're not just, you know, a waste of space. I mean, and these are very important relationships because we need reminding of that.
So they're the people who, like, is it very basic to say, you want to be around people who make you feel good about yourself and not be around the people who try to undermine you and make you feel bad about yourself?
Well, I think there are relationships that make me feel who I am, and then there are unhealthy relationships that diminish me and make me help me I lose a sense of who I am. I get lost in them. And then there are non-existent relationships that leave me feeling isolated and lonely. And that's another problem. But, you know, relationships are without a doubt the fundamental pillar of immunity and in psychological terms, and we need to think about them. And I do think that, just to come back to Hilda's experience, because that's the system I worked in all my life. And sadly,
and this is just for anyone who didn't hear it. She was just unlucky, I think, with the first professional that she went to see after she had been very depressed and suicidal, basically told her, well, look, you could cop yourself on, kind of, that you are a very privileged person. You've nothing to be complaining about, kind of.
Yeah, and I wish I could say that was an out-and-out exception, but I think, you know, I saw that happen many times over the years. I'm sure I was at fault myself in saying things that were unhelpful, but I think we need to be held to account as mental health professionals, and the measure of our work, the measure of what we do, is primarily that we give people back a sense of their dignity. Mm. And secondly, that we help them take hold of their lives again. I had a doctor, a GP, a wonderful man, and I went to him for years. Most of the time I went to him, I hoped for some pain relief or, you know, morphine drip or box of oxycodone or something mild just to take away pain. I never got that. In fact, I would say the majority of the times I never left with any script at all. And sometimes when I went to him, he didn't know what was wrong with me, and he was really curious. But I'll tell you something. Whenever I left him, I felt so much better.
Yeah.
I felt I could live. I felt I was. I realized that, you know, he would either figure out with me what was going on, and I knew that it wouldn't be some makey-uppy sort of diagnosis. It would be the real deal. Or it would be that, which was the mostly the case, that whatever was wrong with me would right itself over time with with some little advice that he gave me, you know.
Yeah, I prefer to walk out of a doctor with a bit of reassurance and feel I wasted the money than to walk out with antibiotics or whatever most of
the time. Well, you know, but he was great. He never did. But I think that's the, I think that has to be the measure of how we treat people.
Yeah, okay. And look, we don't, like Hilda did say, that guy was a great psychiatrist or psychologist or whatever. That he had been very good with other people, just wasn't for her. But listen, we digress, because you're not a tips merchant, but you were actually starting to give us tips there. So the story we tell ourselves, beginning with looking after the body and then having good relationships that make us feel ourselves. And
you, two other things. Yeah. And I think the two other things are, we need a feeling of coherence. We need to see that our life makes sense, that we are all a product of many things that have happened to us, and that given what we brought to this pandemic and given the particular way it disrupted our life and the particular resources we had or didn't have, how we've felt and how we've behaved is not that surprising. And most of us did the best we could, and we survived to tell the tale, and we're still here. So we need that sense of things making sense. And finally, I think we need inspiration. We need it. We need to watch. We need to read. We need to go deeper. We need some inspiration, because living inside.
Now, when you say inspiration, is it because you're afraid to say the word, maybe spirituality?
Well, probably.
It's not verboten. It's a Sunday after all.
It's easier to talk about sexuality than spirituality in some ways, but it is. You know, I always think living inside our head can become very exhausting and a very cramped place. And psychology necessarily is focused on the person, the I, the me, how I'm getting through. And that's really to give people a sense of dignity and coherence about their lives. But I think we need something more. And I think, you know, we need to be reminded that we're part of something greater. And that is where spirituality kicks in. But it happens in very simple ways. I suspect it's happened for many of your listeners over the last 18 months, whether they've been immersing themselves in the sea and looking up at the stars, whether they've been baking bread and sharing it with neighbours, or reading material or listening to material that has really lifted them, that people have become aware that, you know, it's not just all about me. I'm part of something bigger. And this something bigger is invariably about other people. I am connected to other people. COVID has, I think, accentuated our sense of how interconnected we all are, and not just with people, but with nature and other living things.
Yeah, there's a book I really like by two philosophers, Bert Dreyfus and Sean Kelly, and they have a notion in it, Tony, called whooshing up. And the example they use is, if everyone's in a stadium, somebody scores a goal, people don't think. All together, they rise to their feet. It's as if, like, God moves through the place or something, and everybody just goes together. They're out of their own heads, and they're part of that bigger thing. And it's kind of flow and a lack of awareness of the self, maybe. But whooshing up, they call it. But that's kind of what it is, isn't it? Whooshing up into something, into the bigger thing, like, and forget ourselves for a while.
I think that's very important. It's to getting into the flow of our relationship with the other being nature, the other being other people. But it's just, we're in the flow of life. And a lot of the time we're in psychology, we're tinkering around with the sort of the machinery. But actually living is about something more than psychology. It's about stepping into the flow. And those moments are way more than 5.75 on an off satisfaction scale.
Yeah. Are you, in a way, Tony, are you gone beyond psychology in a sense in your own kind of journey, like as a professional and as a person? Do you feel there's something beyond what conventional psychology is, that more into a space of spirituality or wisdom? Or is that what good psychology is?
That's a powerful question. You know, it's funny. In the last year and a half, one of the ways that I've benefited from COVID and the pandemic has been that I've read back into psychology. And I realised how little I knew. I mean, even terms like mental health, trauma, you know, what attachment, what really did these things mean? I had a good working knowledge of them, but I've really appreciated going back to some of the real thought leaders in psychology. So yeah. I love psychology. I love it, and it's always brought me out of myself, and it's always made me aware of the beauty of people. I mean, it really highlights dignity for me, which is what I most love about it. But I think that it has, we have gotten, you know, tainted perhaps by kind of spiritual experiences and practices and memories and so on. So, and the psychology isn't big enough for the human being. It needs, we need another layer of consciousness on top of our own psychological self-awareness. And that for me is spirituality. And I think that I want to point towards that. I mean, Carl Jung said, unless people over 35, unless they could see something in that world, unless they had some relationship, what he called some religious practice, they didn't get well. And I think what he meant was they didn't flourish, they didn't thrive, they didn't come alive. And it's not just about getting over symptoms, it's about flourishing, it's about thriving. And yeah. I think spirituality, however we come to it, and I like to think of it as, you know, our relationship with beauty and mystery. That's what it is. And, you know, but it, you know, when you've got a sense of dignity, you can face almost any challenge. But when you see a bigger picture than yourself, you yeah. have a reason for wanting to live and wanting to face those challenges.
Yeah, because often, like, you know, we've become really, that term mental health is being bandied around, you know, a lot now. But I often think when I hear people talking about what they're saying is their mental health, they often sound like more, that it's more their emotional health they're talking yes. about, or even a spiritual kind of malaise. But I guess it's a blurred line, is it, between like that the brain does this stuff, but that it's maybe is it the soul that is at, that is the thing with the problem sometimes.
Mental health has become a catch-all for so many things, and you know, you always have to, it's great, it's given us some kind of language to talk about our inner lives, which is good. We're waking up, we're becoming more, well, we're growing up. I think psychology and mental health is about growing up. Spirituality is about waking up. But I think that it gets tiresome because people don't know quite what it means, and very often it's used in a negative way. That I'm not. I remember a colleague when I was in class came in one day and she had been to the doctor and she said, "I have blood pressure. I have blood pressure." You know,
yeah,
and
yeah.
thinking, well, you know, honey, you wouldn't be alive if you didn't have blood pressure.
Yeah.
But you know, we all have mental health, and part of mental health is mental pain. I mean, it's not just the absence of everything unpleasant. It's an ability to cope with mental pain. And everybody on the face of the planet has mental pain, because as soon as you have a mind, you've got pain. It can always imagine something better. It can always want something more. I mean, it's quite a tricky thing to handle. So I think, you know, we have the spectrum between mental pain and getting stuck in that, which is not a good thing, and we've got, and then between and flourishing and thriving and having a more soulful life, which is, I think, when we're happiest as human beings.
Yeah. Listen, can I go back to one thing before we finish up, because I'm curious about it, and I think you could maybe expand on it a bit more. This notion of the story we are telling ourselves, because I feel that, you know, I feel it myself a lot of time, and I think a lot of people, a lot of us are living, telling ourselves stories that really don't serve us anymore, or don't, if they ever served us well. And we kind of, I think we, a lot of us cripple and limit ourselves a little bit with the stories we tell ourselves. I know I'm putting on the spot now, but like, how do we start changing the story we are telling ourselves to something more productive or useful or flourishing?
Well, quoting something you said earlier, you know, when we come across new facts, you know, we can change our view. And I think the beauty of this paper, it's not, you know, it's a lot of work, and I admire the but it's not perfect. But the beauty of the paper is that it's saying to us, look at, it is possible. It is possible for us to renew ourselves, to for life to renew ourselves. It's something extraordinary. And that message is a new story. And it's the message that the most vulnerable need to hear. They need to know that, you know, working with them, that it is possible that for even given the enormity of pain they've been through, it is possible to have another kind of experience. Now, there may be lots of practical life issues that have to be attended to in their life, because they didn't just get unwell. They had financial difficulties, they had toxic relationships, lots of stuff to deal with. So we're not just trying to adjust people's mood to make them feel better. Real mental health support is to help people address those issues in their life that have been very toxic and stressful for them. But the point is, they still need to know it is possible. And Brendan, I've worked for years with people who were horribly abused, people in dire social situations, people who were traumatized beyond anything speakable. And I saw them just come back to life, you know. I didn't make them come back to life. I didn't cure them. But somehow I was a part of it. But they came back to life. And I thought they never could after what they'd been. I didn't think I could. But it is possible.
You didn't think you could what?
I didn't think I could have survived the kind of experiences that they survived. I mean, they were really difficult. And yet they showed me what, you know, forget this paper. The lives of very hurt people have shown me that it is possible to renew ourselves, to begin again, to start over. And that's the most inspiring thing I took from 30 years of working in a psychiatric hospital.
Okay. Tony, thanks for that. Have you done some notes on this for us?
Yes, I did some notes, and they're a little different than what you and I have discussed, but they're there, and it's really around the issue of the story we're telling ourselves, and for it not to be a story of despair, a narrative of despair.
Okay. Well, listen, Dr. Tony Bates, always a pleasure, and I know that a lot of people do get a lot out of those notes, and you're very, very good to do them for us. Listen, there is one text I'm going to mention at the end there, and I know that you would heartily agree with this. It's a texter saying, JH in Dublin, I'm a GP. We're definitely seeing a rise in mental health presentations this year. Mild symptoms in general, but significant numbers. Millennials really suffering at the moment from double jeopardy of loss of opportunity to be with family, friends, lovers, and job insecurity and housing anxieties. Millennial teenagers are the really vulnerable groups now.
Absolutely.
And you would, I know, agree with all that. And just to make the point that you're not in any way suggesting here that this has not caused terrible distress and pain and anxiety, but that just offering the perspective that there is hope. And as you were saying there at the end, that change is possible. Do you remember those the parking machines when they came in first? They for some reason, whoever programmed them, it used to come up when you'd put in your ticket, change is possible, would come up in the thing. And I always thought, this is a very philosophical parking machine. Remember that when they, a few years ago? I think they've changed them now, but they should have kept it. Change is possible. A few texters there, Tony, wondering, did you say a prayer to St. Anthony at all?
Well, you know, I was
when you lost the wallet?
I did.
You did, of course you did.
I promised him 20 euro. I've got to give somebody 20 euro. There's a deal I made here.
Okay. There are more things in heaven and earth than your psychology or whatever it was.
Dead right.
Was it Hamlet said it?
Oh, you're right.
Dr. Tony Bates, thank you very much. And those notes up on the website. And we'll take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.